Hi there. Welcome to Mushroom Hour. Today on Mushroom Hour, we have the honor of being joined once again by mycological legend, Daniel Winkler. A mushroom educator, trained ecologist, and award-winning photographer, he grew up collecting mushrooms in the Austrian Alps. Daniel has been foraging for more than 25 years in the Pacific Northwest, in addition to South America and High Asia, where he is involved in ethnomycological fieldwork. He served as vice president of the Puget Sound Mycological Society, who recognized his lifetime of service with their Golden Mushroom Award. Through his travel agency, Mushrooming, Daniel runs mushroom-focused eco-tours to Tibet, Bhutan, the Amazon, Colombia, and the Austrian Alps, as well as in the Pacific Northwest. Today, we're going to dive into his newest field guide, Fruits of the Forest, a field guide to Pacific Northwest edible mushrooms. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us once again on the Mushroom Hour.
Thank you for having me. And I was chortling here a little bit. Don't raise too much expectation here, okay? Low expectation is the key to happiness.
Well, I saw you laughing when I said that. I'm like, no, for me, you are a mycological legend. It was a pretty formative experience in Mendocino, I think in 2016 or 2017, where I got to go mushroom hunting with yourself, Larry Evans, Ken Litchfield, and David from MSSF.
Oh, cool.
And my mind was blown. Yeah, so... The legendary title is, maybe that's purely in my mind, but I have to use it. I think the name fits. Well, we've had you on before talking about Yartsugumbu. We've had you on before really giving an extensive history of your field work there and your backstory. So I won't go over all of it again.
No.
But give us a little update, though, of just the past couple of years. Because last time we spoke, obviously, was a strange time in the world. Mushrooming kind of was on pause. So what's been going on, 2020 to now?
Well, yeah, mushrooming has been on pause ever since COVID hit. So we still could do one trip in Colombia and left the country 2 days before the lockdown started there. So that was where you could get that doses of beautiful mushrooms and a great trip. And then I got home, worked on my pictures, and before I had already signed a contract with the Mountaineers Publishing in Seattle to write a mushroom book. And a field guide for edibles of the Pacific Northwest. And so that was really perfect timing. I was grounded and had to focus, which is not always easy. And all these more exotic mushrooms from the Amazon or the Himalayas or Tibet went in the background. And I was really focusing here on our fungi and our edible mushrooms. And luckily, we still could go out in the forests. So I could do some more photography and some more research in the woods. So that was very helpful and very enjoyable. Also, being out there alone was a new experience, but it was cool too, because the mushrooms were there. So I wasn't that alone. So that's basically, that was the last 2.5 years, just much less travel and no mushrooming tours and working on the book. And so the final revision was sometime in July. And, it went to the printers and the first copies showed up 6 weeks ago. We had some airmailed printouts, and now it's 3 weeks ago I finally had the book and I've been mailing out and, and going to mushroom events here in the Pacific Northwest. First, I was selling book futures because there was no book there.
But, book futures.
Yeah. Which made a lot of work. Anyways, and now I've have it with me and really enjoy meeting all these people and seeing all that interest. And it's really something that was missing so far. We have a whole bunch of really good books for the Pacific Northwest at this point. But when it comes to edibility, it's often understated. And, the last book that really goes into edibility is David Aurora's Whatever the Rain Promises, published in 1990. And it's still one of the most popular ones out here, though it is not specific to the Pacific Northwest. It has, of course, a lot of California and goes into the Rockies and so on. It is Western United or Western North America. But, 32 years later, a lot of things have changed. Even David has changed his ideas about edibility and what makes a good mushroom quite a bit. You know, he used to rhyme things like about the Russula brevipes, better kicked than cooked, or stuff like that. And he has also changed his mind how these firm Russulas really offer something to the table. So, yeah, that's been the last 2.5 years. And I'm so glad I wrote it all down, because I don't have such a incredible memory that I could retain toxic chemicals or certain things, you know. It's like, no, I'm looking myself, I'm looking up in my book, the facts I can't retain, but I put time into researching.
Well, that was one of my big questions, was, you know, how you assemble this compendium of knowledge. And as someone who has not written a book and is kind of overawed by the idea of writing a book and the process that takes, and I guess enforced discipline in your case definitely helped. But, you know, for that book writing process, was this a mixture? Was this, you know, your own stories, anecdotes from other foragers? Are you reading medical journals? All of the above? You know, how do you pull the information together to make this book, again, focused on kind of edibility and the forage experience? You know, where does that information come from?
So, yeah, all of the above. And when I start out things, I don't have a clear vision, you know, this is how it's gonna be. And looking back, it's like, dude, you should have maybe sat down first and write a list of all the mushrooms and go through books, you know, anything that's been written on edible mushrooms and search for what's out there. Of course, at some point in the process, I did that, and it never ends finding something.
Right.
I definitely was inspired partially by what's out there already and what is missing in what's out there already. And in the beginning, I had the idea of maybe making the descriptions less technical. And I'm still trying to do it as little technical as possible, but I have my own memories using whatever the rain promises. And, you know, it's like, these 7 lines David offers, just, it's like, that's not enough, really. I don't feel safe, you know? So I thought I put more in there, and maybe I just don't have this perspective, you know, David Aurora had after writing Mushrooms Demystified, that he could exclude everything else. This is just that one mushroom. But I wanted to, so on one side, really have proper descriptions of all our edible mushrooms, and edible, we got to talk about that separate. What is edible? And I wanted also to have really good pictures that show the details, because most of us work with images, work with visual recognition, you know, especially when we use a mushroom book, right? And I thought also it is important that we have common names for mushrooms, because, every other country but the Canada and US do have a semi-official list for common names. And, you know, everywhere in Europe or China, Japan, and so on, people made that effort. And that is not necessary to help the mycologists or the people who spend much of their time for mushroom identification or mushroom hunting, but to reach out to the people and to make mushrooms part of the life of more people, and not just this, you know, small corner of supposedly daredevils who go out there and put their life each time on the line when they pick a wild mushroom and can't control themselves and be safe in the supermarket, right? And be happy with button mushrooms. So I think common names are really important, and I went through whatever is out there already in common names, and sometimes I find beautiful common names and others, okay, some I had to make up because there was none ever done. They were recently described, and it's not even part here of the tradition of, you know, you describe a new mushroom and that people, if I get in that situation, I will come up also with a suggested common name, you know. So anyways, that was a big part of it. Then I had to think hard of it in regard of what area do I want to cover? And I just know a mushroom book gets so much better by given a limited region. So, you know, when I first came here to the US in the mid 90s, and the first book I had was just Audubon Mushrooms of North America by Gary Linkhoff. And I was a curse using that in the Pacific Northwest. You know, you go through all the images, finally you find an image, and okay. And then even there, the issue that the common names and the scientific names were separated. So, and then, oh, okay, that's it. And then, oh, Missouri, Arkansas. Okay, can't be that one. So it's really, especially getting into it, the more regional your field guide, the easier it is. And the easier also, an important part is talking about lookalikes. And of course, yes, the lookalikes for a chanterelle are quite different if you, you know, if you're out in Mississippi, California, or in British Columbia. So that is the thing. Economically, sure, you make that mushrooms, edible mushrooms of North America, you have a much, much bigger market, but it's not fair. You know, it's not fair to the people. We have a couple of these books and they just stay very general and they pick a few things, you know, and okay, Hen of the Woods, that's for the East Coast. We don't have that. That's not a big deal. But so that was an important thing, is that that regional perspective, because that's very important for habitat, seasonality, you know, and the lookalikes. And already talking about seasonality, it's so hard. You know, you look at what's fruiting down on the Pacific coast, the western slope, like of the Cascades, for example, or then in Northern California, the Sierra versus Eastern Cascades, or then into the Rockies or Alaska. So things that, you know, only will fruit here in late fall when the rains are back, and they happen somewhere high up in the mountains in summer, or in Alaska, it's all much earlier too. And so, you know, you don't want to repeat that with each mushroom when you describe them. So people, you know, in the intro, I talk about that, you know, some of these things you got to adjust for your area, and you got to figure that out. If you, you know, in the Rockies, the fruiting patterns are different, and so much more will happen in late summer or summer when there's thunderstorms versus out here where we have these dry summers.
Well, and as so many mushroom hunters know, the microclimates and the effects that can happen, you know, in such small regional areas. So yes, probably the more regional, the better. So that makes a lot of sense. And you brought up an interesting concept, which is the author yourself, the seasoned mycological, you know, mycologist, I mean, battling your own umwelt. I mean, the way you see the world and how you already know mushrooms, you have to kind of pare some of that back so you're not assuming too much. That must be an interesting side of being an author. And I know that it seems like this book builds off of the pamphlet you wrote back in 2011 about edible mushrooms in the Pacific Northwest. But am I wrong in saying this is your first guidebook? This is the first Daniel Winkler official kind of full guidebook.
Right. So this, and just as you said, you know, that's a scary enterprise to go that way. And I had already contracts ready to sign with a publishing house. Falcon has these series on mushroom books for each state. And I just, you know, the conditions were just ridiculous as an author. And I don't like it. It's just way too superficial. And you know, there's issues with quality too. And so, you know, I was definitely hesitant. I wasn't waiting for the first opportunity to jump onto it. It's like, okay, you can't run away. And then my wife and daughters also, come on, you can do it, go for it. And yeah, and then I figured, you know, it's like I have accumulated so much knowledge and experience over the years that, you know, maybe at some point I want to do something else, and to walk away from that without having put that down in writing would be a pity. And also another thing is that I think I can offer perspectives, you know, certain things others won't have. And that's having grown up mushroom hunting in Europe, you know, where there is so much more knowledge about edibility of mushrooms and such a longer history, and where there is research money available, where people look into toxins and nutrients in mushrooms, you know, where yes, you can get mycology research grants here too, but it's so much easier to get a grant to do diversity study in the Amazon than to look at, you know, what are these toxins we have in certain mushrooms if they're not deadly, right? So who cares? And there is just so much more knowledge available in the other countries. And, you know, I can read some of that in other languages. And then also, like, I have a Norwegian mushroom friend, and I couldn't read Norwegian. I mean, yeah, I can recognize some words because it's a Germanic language, but then you just, I put it in Google Translate and can make sense of it. And then I would run it by Paul. Okay, did I get that right? And so there's just, you know, and it's very interesting, like when it comes to mushrooms like the woolly vase or the woolly chanterelle, there's no history of, it doesn't occur in Europe. So there is no European tradition of edibility. So there's a lot of rumors around edibilities and problems. And it makes a real big difference. You know, certain mushrooms we have here, but like the woolly chanterelle is out in East Asia, and there I've seen it on the markets, and it's in Mexico where you can find it on the market. And here we have stories about it has an accumulative liver toxin. And Noah Siegel, he was trying to find any source for that. And he said, I couldn't. I looked everywhere. You know, that was just like a urban mushroom hunter myth. And, but yes, a whole bunch of people get a reaction to it, and we don't regard it as a good or generally recommended edible mushrooms. And that's such another interesting aspect. What mushrooms do I put in there? So I talk about the 14 fantastic mushrooms. I don't know why I didn't call it the 14 fantastic fungi, which usually I love these alliterations, but I might have been a little shy there. And, which is the easy ones, easy to identify without dangerous lookalikes, and which has only very few gilt mushrooms, because there's so much more challenge to getting to know your gilt mushrooms. But then, you know, like in the fold out I did on for mushrooms for the Pacific Northwest, I think I have 55 edible species. And now I have 185 main species in the book. And there's still some which I wished, oh, I could have put that in. Like Cordyceps militaris is an excellent edible, you know, and having done all that Cordyceps research. But on the other side, it is so extremely rare in the Pacific Northwest, you know, that it's like, okay, I better use the pages for something else. And it was too late in the game where, okay, Daniel, this is getting too much here. So, but, you know, there's such a gray area between choice edibles that upset hardly anyone. There's always a few. And other ones where, you know, is it a third of the people who get a reaction or is it 10%? But, you know, these then already interesting numbers. And how much of that is that people don't prepare it properly, like knowing they have to cook it very well. And, you know, like one of the interesting examples here is the Lexinums, the Scaba stalks, especially the red-capped ones, the brown birch scaba stalk or birch bullied, hardly anybody gets a reaction to. And what I found is that the red and orange staining ones, they contain serocomin, which is a pigment, but that upsets digestive systems. So seeing these things, you know, which totally correlates to the issue of edibility between these Lexinums, that apparently the red ones, reddish orange ones, cause more problems than the brown ones. That and then the serocomin is can be eliminated by 20 minutes of cooking, you know, which often this thing, this thorough cooking is a big deal, rendering certain mushrooms edible. The lobster is another example where some people get reactions, and you know, one thing is undercooking and the other one is often, because they can be for weeks and months in the environment, and you know, people bring home these really old lobsters and then probably get an upset digestive system from rotten proteins. And interestingly, this is one of the mushrooms that is endemic to North America, which has no culinary history outside of North and Central America. So you know.
Hypomyces is not, okay.
Hypomyces is distributed, and in Europe, a few people, and I've seen it on the market in Tibet, eat the green hypomyces.
What you're bringing up, though, is kind of, I like how you said that, kind of urban mushroom legends, and we're not always tying that to exactly what compounds are causing that effect. Even in my own head, that's a little blurry. You hear tales of stomach upset. So I love how you tied that to, like, there is a compound causing that. Here's how you treat it, and you're diving right into, you know, what is edibility. Yeah. So for your book, I mean, how do you make those choices? I mean, I guess you make it very clear how to prepare and cook. I guess right. All those caveats, that's where that comes
for the
in.
Questionable, I make it very clear they're questionable. So, you know, it's like a mushroom, like the brain mushroom or the false morel, Chiromitra, right? Where it's such a hot button issue that online discussions are usually after 35 contributions, it gets shut down each time because, you know, we're not getting anywhere. And so this really reminded me of a little bit of another contemporary situation. So here, if I may read that from my book, not surprisingly, differences in opinion on the edibility of the brain mushroom is the fungal equivalent to political polarization in the US. While micro-conservatives fearfully focus on the lethal toxicity, micro-progressives point to the transformative power of proper processing, which is less challenging than correctly gutting fugu fish. While most mushroom hunters shun brain mushrooms for good reason, since plenty of foragers have been seriously sickened, others praise its flavor and structure and claim it's superior to regular morels. Some micro-progressives invoke Finnish mushroomers who dryly state, if false morels were deadly, there would be no Finns. So I go on and on, and it just shows that. And then in the end, you know, I talk, there's even some people try to connect now chiromitrin, the toxicity of the chiromitras with incidence of Lou Gehrig disease. Based on a research in a small village in France that has these incredible high numbers of ALS, which is the acronym for Lou Gehrig disease. And, but there is no other villages that are compared to. And, but they make that statement that most of the people who end up with Lou Gehrig disease also talk about having had a poisoning of through chiromitrin. So not just eaten them, but have had a poisoning. And then in the end, I said, and by the way, did I mention it's a poisonous mushroom? So it's really, I'm not telling people what to eat and what not to eat, but I try to show what's out there. And then you make your own decisions. And most people will stay away from questionable mushrooms. And other people, it's just like, they gotta know it, you know? Oh man, you know, there's another challenge. And you know, I was just irked looking at a lot of mushroom books, and then it would say edibility unknown, or there was no reference to edibility, you know. And while we all know that probably 90-95% of mushroom book sales is people who want to eat the mushrooms.
Of course.
And yeah. That was ignored by a lot of authors. And I think they're coming slowly around and realize that just even from a market share perspective, you know, you got to do a little bit more work in that regard. And you know, and just that one sentence, you know, this is an edible mushroom, or this is a choice edible mushroom, or some people eat it, you know. So I know people want more. I wanted to know more. And, you know, running into mushrooms here like the dusty bolete, Porphyrellus, Porphyrosporus, or whatever, Porphyroboletus, which I don't cover in detail in the guidebook, but I just remember so clearly I found them, and it's like I tried to key them out, and I see, wait a minute, this is a European name. There's still ambiguity around it. Well, that came later on, but we're using a European name for that mushroom here, and edibility unknown. It's like I look up in my German mushroom book, and yeah, it is an edible mushroom. And so that empowered me early on when I got here to eat things where other books were just not going, that I would look up, What do my German books say? And, you know, there's really interesting papers published in Italy about edibility of mushrooms, you know, where newest research is tied in Scandinavia, like a joint research organization for the Scandinavian country has two papers out on edibility of mushrooms and really goes into detail into stuff which we don't have yet published for the US or for, you know. So I wished I had these ones right in the beginning when I started my work. So I found them a little later on. And I have footnotes in the book, which was a big struggle with the publishers. Our field guide shouldn't have footnotes. But, you know, when I say puffballs have been recorded with 48% protein in the dry state, I mean, that needs a reference, right? So there's still a few places where I wished I had put in a reference. That was in the beginning where, you know, I was discouraged. But then at some point I said, no, we can't get around that. And so I have footnotes and references. And that's also how I was used to work scientifically. You know, when you state certain things, you want to give a footnote.
Well, and I really appreciate that about the book. And I find with the authors whose books I reference the most, it seems like so much material is pulled from other cultures, other languages, a lot of Asian research journals and things of that nature, especially for medicinal compounds, I know have to be referenced. So yeah, really interesting hearing the backstory, and it makes you think, man, if we could just be polyglots or, you know, just people that could speak a million languages, someone could put together the picture of some of these mushrooms a little bit better. But, you know, part of this whole question of edibility is something else you brought up in the book that, again, we all know about, but in terms of how we practically use that knowledge or really how much we understand it, for me at least, is limited. But that's heavy metals, pesticides, toxicity getting uptaken by edible mushrooms. Talk about that a little bit, you know, what research we know about that process, and maybe practically then how a forager uses that to guide what mushrooms they're picking while they're out in the wild.
Yeah, so I spent weeks on that subject here doing research and trying, what do I come up with? And I think, is it 3 or 4 pages in the book where, you know, under the heading, where not to pick mushrooms or so. Yeah. And there's so little out in the US and Canada, you know, and I just couldn't believe it. It's growing up in Munich, Germany, and then Chernobyl happened when I was, 23 or so. I mean, we quit mushroom hunting for years because of the cesium and the radioactivity that ended up in the mushrooms. Mm. And that was really a painful period. And a Japanese friend of mine here, who used to be a member of Puget Sound Mycological Society, she moved just back to Japan after the nuclear accident there. And
Fukushima.
Fukushima. I was Fujiyama, and I knew I'm off here. Fukushima. And then you look around, and there's so much research on heavy metals and mushrooms. I mean, I found a paper on heavy metals in Nigeria and mushrooms, you know, but you try to find a paper here, very little. So here in this Puget Sound, Erica Klein did a study and showed some, you know, where there is water treatment sludge brought in the forest for fertilization, that there is a real problem that these mushrooms get loaded with metals. And I know in Germany that practice of using these water treatment sludges were outlawed right in the 70s because of all the heavy metals you bring out into the environment when you use it for fertilization. And yes, it's full of nutrients, but it's full of heavy metals too, you know. And so, I spent quite a time on that. And we have a case of one gentleman on the East Coast who actually died from eating morels. He was specialized. Joe, let's see if I find his name. He was specialized on picking morels on old apple orchards. And these apple orchards were treated for years and years with lead arsenate. And that is still in the soil. So this didn't disappear, and the mushrooms take it up. So
what an important story, as many people say, to target old apple fields because of the calcium used to find morels. So that's an important cautionary tale.
Yeah. So if you, I mean, out here, the blondes or the white morels, the blonde morels are not that important, or yellow morels, right? Because we have all the fire morels and many more species of black morels. But east of the Rockies, the blondes are just much more common and more hunted, and they are associated with apple trees especially. And so, and he would eat that daily. He would visit all these old orchards in New Jersey and New York, and then supposedly his nightcap was a morel, one of these. And yeah, and in the end, he got such problems, and he had a good doctor that recognized what's going on. They excluded all other pathways of getting that into his system, and tried to get it out of his system through chelation. And in the end, he died. So. So this is the one case we have here, but not having other cases, I think, is actually very helpful information. So what of these heavy metals are really biosoluble? So what of it will actually be taken up in our system? And I found contradicting research there, and that was quite dated. You know, some German research that said, oh, we can't see any uptake, and everybody seems to be fine. And then other research that showed, oh, we can see it here in rats. It ends up in fatty tissue and organs and so on. So basically the bottom line is you got to be aware. Don't pick your mushrooms, especially mine tailings, you know. Don't pick them where there is a history of pollution, like, you know, where there was industrial activity along roadways, along railroads, where there was spraying of toxins. And of course, you know, these mushrooms are, some of them are real specialists in accumulating heavy metals. And for the most common eaten mushrooms, these are, of course, our agaricus, like the brinz and so on. And then the lacaria. So I wanted to put in the Western amethyst deceiver, as the common name is of Lacaria amethysto occidentalis. And it turns out that the arsenic levels are just crazy in these little beautiful purple mushrooms, which, you know, I was on a bandwagon. Hey, these guys, you know, nice structure. And okay, if they don't, you know, if the fungal taste is not totally convincing you, it's too subtle. Well, just, you know, add a little bit of sherry when you deglaze them, and then it's really enjoyable. Good structure, and they're so beautiful and so on. But then it turns out these are really some of the mushrooms that have the most arsenic, as is a cup fungus that is half underground in spring, the purple coronaria, Sarcocypha coronaria. And, you know, which I said, oh, well, nobody talks about how it's edible. And I figured out there's people who eat it, and they use them as a container to stuff them with whatever stuffing. And then I found out, oh, these guys can put, you know, you can basically in a meal, you can get an annual dose of arsenic out of them. So, you know, that's not an edible mushroom, right? Even if you don't die.
One, it's something I know amateur foragers like myself, I don't really think about. I'm not thinking about heavy metals. I'm not thinking about pesticides. I'm not thinking about land use of the parcels near where I'm foraging. And I really appreciated you having an area dedicated to that in the book. Made me think a little more. You know, maybe, you know, here in California, we have GeoTracker, where you can hop on and see environmentally sensitive sites reported around the state. Yeah, maybe we have to check the GeoTracker, make sure there wasn't something underground there or something like that.
I think at least check out where you live and where you frequently go. And of course, in areas where there's active mining, you have to watch out. And, you know, it's the same story as eating certain fish, you know, that are high up in the food chain. So if you have a daily habit, that is a problem at this point. If you eat it once in a while, you should be fine. I mean, you know, hopefully our kidneys or whatever will eliminate these things and liver. But it is something to pay a little attention to. And anybody talking about edible mushrooms, and even in an introductory level, usually mentions, be aware of the environment where you pick your mushrooms. But, you know, there's no point in just questioning every mushroom you eat. That's, you know, no reason for paranoia. But like, for example, you know, in the Telluride area where there's a lot of tailings and so on. So if you see that you're finding these lovely porcinis on a place that has been mined and this is actually tailings, maybe take some nice pictures and leave them there. Or, you know, you tell you, well, once in a lifetime, but, you know, so you know, these are things that are hard to decide. And sometimes I'm worried if I'm a little too negative there. And now I'm spending this time talking about that, the heavy metals. But, you know, I think it's just something that needs to be out. It needs to be discussed. And hopefully we get some more research and get a clearer picture. And, you know, the bottom line is really how much of these heavy metals are biosoluble. Or do many of them just move through our system? And I ran into a research paper years ago that says, oh, most of it is not biosoluble, and I could not find it, you know? So I wished I had taken a note, and I don't know how, if it was well researched or not, but when I read that, I was, oh, that's great to hear. And
well, and I've also read research about certain fibrous fruits and vegetables that can carry heavy metals out of the body. I think strawberries are one that's really effective at moving certain heavy metals out. So, you know, as we advance understanding this knowledge, maybe it'll be, oh yeah, you can eat the Western Anthus Deceiver, just pair it with some strawberries and then you're, I mean, that's arsenic. But anyway, maybe we'll advance culinarily. We'll find some pairings to mitigate risk. And
well, actually, chitin is good to move out heavy metals out of your system. So you get all these fibers, these soluble and non-soluble fibers in mushrooms. And in this regard, they're the best food group for fibers. And that will move out heavy metals and stuff out of your system. And it's, I think, a Ukrainian pharmaceutical, and that was the only straight mushroom-based pharmaceutical, I think, that was in Europe registered something like 10 years ago, and they're using fungal chitin to remove cesium and other radioactive heavy metals. So, you know, even on one side, they might have it, on the other side, they remove it, and it's so hard to tell, and so I saw the Pennsylvania group is looking into some heavy metal issues, you know, having had all the heavy industry around there. Smelters is a big deal. You have smelters, you know, the downwind from smelters is, there's plenty of research that shows it really will have lots of heavy metals. And yeah, there's even a place here in not far from where I live here, Seattle suburbs. I could imagine living, but I know the soils are just too polluted, and I don't want to, you know, look at mushrooms and say, no, you can't pick them. And so that would be a real good thing for citizen science to look deeper into that and see what can we see. And you know, even some lifetime mushroom hunters, hey, look at your metal values. And I did that, and my lead came out really high, but I don't want to blame it on the mushrooms. Mushrooms do carry lead. They don't bioaccumulate it like many other heavy metals. So they would reflect how much lead is in the environment. Now, if the environment is laced with lead, the mushroom will be laced with lead. But the arsenic, for example, can be 30 times the environmental arsenic. So what I understood, you don't get that out of lead. But still, so I had quite high lead levels, but I also did some plumbing work in the old house around lead piping and cut them without well enough protection, and then dealt often with, you know, lead paints, old house.
Right.
So I could think that was, I got a much higher dose that way than from loving my mushrooms.
I think we have to chalk that up to the house, not necessarily the mushrooms. And, you know, as we're talking, Daniel Stevenson, in here in California, has done research, academic research into heavy metal uptake. I think her research is mostly focused on bioremediation, dealing with sites that are contaminated. So yeah, there is some research out there, but a good clarion call to folks to just incorporate it into your thinking, look to explore it more, maybe run a test on the metal concentrations in your body, especially if you're a mycophagist, you eat all kinds of mushrooms. Do that research. Let us know what you find. How much metals do you have? How much metals do you have in you? Well, you know, and not to keep us on too grim of a track here with edibility.
Yeah, no. Let's get out of there.
But one that I wanted to mention, because it's in my notes and because I was a little shocked by it, was it sounds like you've changed some of your perspective on the other organisms that like to eat our mushrooms. The maggots, the larvae that we find in our mushrooms. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, I don't want to be overly sensational, but it was just shocking.
We are all one. And that, of course, must include the larvae too. And
right.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just as upset as everybody else when I find a beautiful, you know, king bullet, and then it looks all perfect, and then you touch it, and then suddenly you see, well, there's the stem is all hollow, and it's already taken over by the larvae. So, you know, and then having traveled in Asia and the Amazon and seeing how people eat insects, you know, and how read a whole bunch of stuff of it, and how we have this schizophrenic approach to insects. As soon as they're in the water, like shrimp, a scampi, you know, oh, these are really special, really special, expensive food items. But if the insects are not in the water, they're complete taboo in European food traditions, right? And then you get into many other cultures and you see how people, you know, eat larvae, how larvae are the densest, one of the densest protein food sources there is around. And in Colombia, we visited this town where there's a tradition of eating ants, you know, and yeah, they're a little crunchy and salty. The main point was in the end, how fresh was the oil that people were using to frying them, you know? So I parboiled a Sparassus, a Western cauliflower mushroom, for pickling it. And then there was a couple larvae floating, and they were big. You know, I had forgotten that I had it. It was sitting out there 2 weeks in a paper bag, cool outside the porch. And then said, okay, what the heck? I go for it. And, you know, well, caterpillar fungus. I already had to cross the line years ago eating caterpillar fungus, which in the beginning, I wasn't excited at all trying it. And, you know, I was the guest of honor at a banquet in Tibet, and they offered me the caterpillar fungus that was sitting in the bottle of an alcohol, you know, like the
worm and tequila.
Tequila worm. Same story there. And, you know, I just had to do it, all the eyes on me. And okay, it had a good fungal taste. I mean, there was no insect taste anymore. It was all fungus. It was nutty. It was quite oily too, sweet a little bit. So I was, wow, I didn't expect that. But it took a little longer to get to that appreciation. First, there was just the disgust eating a worm, right? And so it turned out the larvae there and the sparassus, they had after being boiled, they were rubbery on the outside, but inside there was a sweet, pleasant tasting white paste and, you know, supposedly full of nutrients, right? So, you know, I mean, that's the responsibility if you write a book about edible mushrooms, you know, you got to see who else eats them, right? And knowing these guys never ate anything but mushrooms. So, yeah, I'm not going to make it a habit now looking for rotten bullets or sparassus to get to this, to these tasty larvae. No, no. But, you know, it was just a fun thing to do. And I think the main point is just don't get too uptight about a few larvae in your mushrooms. You know, it's yes, we'd like to have not a single larvae in there, but that's not how life works often. And a few of them is definitely, it's not a health risk, and it's all in the mind. And I just hope the love for the bullet will always win out over the fear or the disgust for the larvae. And yes, there is a amount of larvae where there is not much of a bullet left. You got beaten to that one.
That's right. That's right. Sometimes discretion's the better part of valor, but sometimes we don't have to be so sensitive, as I often am when I see any kind of larvae. So yeah, that was speaking directly to me and challenging some of my challenging some of my foraging notions. Well, it's not all heavy metals and larvae. The book is all about choice edible mushrooms. So just to cover a couple, we obviously can't cover them all, but one that I know you're a big fan of, or at least on our last podcast, obviously you're in love with steinpils. You love your bolete, your porcini, but I know you mentioned shaggy parasols. And I noticed there are quite an abundance of shaggy parasols in the guide. So, you know, tell us a little bit about the diversity of shaggy parasols there in the Pacific Northwest, and maybe some of the preparations, some of the way you use them in the kitchen, things like that, just to kind of pull one of these mushrooms out and really highlight it for us.
So the shaggy parasols are mostly, well, there's a lot of them in suburbia. So we have, and that was the research of Elsa Willinger, who was so kind also to look at some of my, help me with a little bit of the taxonomy in that field of the gild mushrooms. I always was trying to have good reviewers, you know, because writing all such a book by yourself is pretty foolish. It's so much nicer if you have another person and it's your team and you're looking over each other's shoulders. You know, it's a little scary doing that all alone. Anyway, so we have three main species of shaggy parasols here in the Pacific Northwest, and that's the gray, the white, and the brown shaggy parasol. So that's Chlorophyllum bruneum, the brown one, which is our native species here, and then two introduced species. This is the gray one, Chlorophyllum olivieri, and then the white and the biggest of them, Rhacoides. And olivieri is more common, much more common west of the Cascades, so in the more milder, more moist climates, and Rhacoides is more distributed, is more common east of the Cascades, so in the drier inland areas. And these bruneum is you find in the forests from California up, and the other ones are not out in the undisturbed forest. So the bruneum is you can find in places where you think there's very little human impact. And all of them are excellent when you just fry the cap, gilts down in butter or in oil, and they have such a rich taste. And even, you know, some people like to describe it as steak. It is definitely a fungal steak because, you know, it has such a nice juicy consistency you know, when you fry it up and you caramelize it nicely, you can add a lot of garlic. They hold their ground. And they fruit often in spring and in fall. So irrigated areas, even in a dry period, they might show up if there's irrigation. And easy to identify with a color change. When you scratch them, they will turn orange or with age a little browner. Yes, they look quite a bit like poisonous amanitas, but that color change is really helpful. And the fact that they have the shaggies, they have the scales on the cap, which our amanitas do not have scales on the cap. So before there was DNA, it was quite a mess. And Elsa Valingas traded that out and, you know, moved them from Macrolepiota into Chlorophyllum. And Chlorophyllum means green gilts, so Greek, like many of our scientific names, are not Latin. They're Greek. They're Latinized Greek. And Chlorophyllum was used previous to that only for these toxic mushrooms, the green spore parasols, which up in the Pacific Northwest were basically no issue till a few years ago. They like hot summers. They grow in lawns, in grassland situation, and up here it was too mild. But now we're getting some records from the southern Willamette Valley and Walla Walla in southeastern Washington. And so that's part of climate change, that there is a toxic species now coming up. And it's actually one of the mushrooms that causes most poisonings in the United States, like in the southeast or Hawaii, you know. People, it looks stately, it's beautiful, and then they might confuse it with the other chlorophyllums that are edible. And some people get a little bit of a reaction. Pruneum is the most suspected troubling shaggy parasol, but you know, we don't know what is problematic, is what chemicals there would be. You gotta cook your mushrooms, and that's definitely one of the ones you have to cook. Yeah, and eating your mushrooms, there's two points here I'd like to make is just the nutritional value of mushrooms is really important. Nutritious ingredients for us, lots of vitamins, minerals, and we get more and more research that tells us how in general it is good for us to eat mushrooms, like this research out of Singapore 2019 that middle-aged to elderly people, when they're eating at least twice a week mushrooms, the onset of early mild cognitive decline. Now I'm already showing that today. My memory is not functioning very well.
Haven't eaten
that mushrooms. That goes down by 50%. So when just eating twice a week mushrooms. Yeah. And I mean, that's just awesome. And, you know, we still have way too little research on, you know, double blind studies on mushrooms and prevention of cancer and so on. But a lot of things point that way. So eating your mushrooms is a really, really good thing. And the other thing which is really crucial is the small carbon footprint mushrooms have. You know, some of them, even you got to grow a forest to grow the mushroom. So I saw some papers that were talking about a positive carbon footprint because you need to produce tree carbon to get to your mushrooms. I don't know how well it always relates to us mushroom lovers when we drive 3 hours to a burn to find our fire morels. You don't want to take into account the carbon production of a forest fire. But in general, you know, cultivated mushrooms, and if you don't drive hours to find your mushrooms, it's really a very small carbon footprint. And something as a society, as, you know, now we are at 8 billion people on this planet, you know, one of the things we have to do, if we don't want to eat larvae, right, we better eat many more mushrooms. And that's I right. don't see a sacrifice in that. It is an enrichment of our lives. And, you know, it doesn't always have to be the morels on top of a steak or something like that. The morels by themselves are such a great meal. And, you know, all these mushrooms we have, and that's part of the thing why I have 180 mushrooms in there. And I mentioned a whole bunch of other mushrooms as well. I should count that are also edible, but, you know, I didn't give them a feature, but they might be mentioned with similar ones or so on, is also the diversity of mushrooms. It's not, you know, there's not just chanterelles and porcini and morels. And yes, you can have a really happy life as a great mushroom hunter, just hunting these three species or three groups of mushrooms. And, and you know, many people do that, and that's perfectly fine. I'm not saying, you know, you're ruining your life by not diversifying. But, you know, if you're curious, if you want to know what grows around you and want to know your mushrooms, it's really fun discovering more and more edible mushrooms and seeing the differences and diversifying your audiostasis would be your portfolio, right? Your fungal portfolio. You know, it's just, it's really great what's out there and the differences in taste. But some of them, it's really like, yeah, I get why I never heard about that being a choice edible, because it's just so darn similar to some really nasty stuff. And, you know, it took me too to cross that line, you know, not having somebody who ate that many times before, but just going by identification and then sending some photos off to tricholoma experts and what about here, this guy and so on, where I find European references, how great it is. And, you know, it is a great mushroom, but many, many people have just didn't go there. And what I'm referring to right now is the streaked night, or the charbonnier in French, the Tricholoma portentosum. So, which is just so similar to the leopard night, Tricholoma perdinum, which is a very toxic mushroom, hasn't killed anybody, but, you know, 3 days of digestive upset, you know, a couple hours is bad enough, but 3 days. So, you know, but I state that very clear. And yes, I do enjoy that mushroom and I'll eat it again and again. But, you know,
that's a fine line to walk. And you wonder how many times authors didn't want to mention edibility if there was a risk like that. So I appreciate you kind of pushing us to the frontiers of edibility. And I love that, our fungal portfolio. That's the only portfolio I have. So yes, of course, we need to expand that portfolio. And that's actually great advice, you know, because chanterelles, porcini, morels, yes, you can live your life with those, be totally happy. But sometimes when you live in an area like I do and you don't have as much time to get into the forest, if you're a weekend warrior, those edibles might be gone. So it's kind of smart to diversify your portfolio and maybe find some of those ones people are leaving behind that, I know from reading Daniel Winkler's book that this actually is a pretty good edible. And so you can still have a day of it, even if all the other waves of foragers got there first. And I was really impressed to see that medicinal aspect brought into it, because I think in All the Rain Promises and More, we probably didn't have quite as much research in that time. But, you know, as we learn more and more at this point, having talked with folks about medicinal mushrooms, yeah, the complex sugars, the fiber, just those two things alone have so much to offer in adding those to your diet. But yeah, just going deeper and just seeing what are the compounds involved, where can we pull research from? So for that element of it, You know, where did you find some of your research for the medicinal side? Is that something new for you? Had you kind of been, I mean, you were working with Ophiocordyceps sinensis. You had to be
exactly.
In the medicinal world.
Exactly. So I got pushed into that. And first I tried to ignore it. And, you know, the whole discussion, is there anything? It's not. Is this just a Chinese pipe dream? You know, and then the whole talk about aphrodisiac and so on. And seeing enough research that as an aphrodisiac, it definitely doesn't work like Viagra, as everybody tries to sell cordyceps as the Himalayan Viagra, which just upsets me because that is so off target. But so yeah. I got into medicinal mushrooms that way, going to the International Medicinal Mushroom Conference, which happens every 2 years in different spots around the world. And I've been maybe to 4 of them or so. And then just hearing about the whole bandwidth, what's out there, you know, and also for veterinary medicine, how people manage to revolutionize their, the meat production by getting off antibiotics, really saving that for actual problems, and otherwise integrating medicinal mushrooms in livestock diets and stuff like that. I never would have thought of, but you know, it's just amazing what's out there. And so I definitely I'm interested. I'm not a medical practitioner. I published with Robert Rogers, one of my foldouts, the medicinal mushrooms of North America. But, you know, I was the mushroom man and Robert Rogers was the medicine man because he has so much more experience. So I learned a lot from Robert and his fungal pharmacy. I also admire very much Chris Hobbs and always used his medicinal mushroom book that already goes back 20, 25 years. And his new one is really beautifully done. And Robert Rogers keeps publishing all kinds of stuff. Collates new research, and it's so nice to see. And the main point here is really empowering people to see there's these medicinal substances out there, you know. And yes, it's your hericium, your lion's mane or the bear's head is a great edible, and we go out there to find it as food. But knowing it has these really nice healing capacities, which in certain cases makes a huge, huge difference when suddenly, you know, you can restore nerve function that was lost for years. And I just met Andrew, who lost control over his little finger and his ring finger for 5 or 6 years. And the doctors told him, yeah, that's lost for the rest of your life. You're not going to get that back. And then he took hericium for half a year and he could move his little finger and ring finger again, you know. So there was serious nerve damage and it was undone. And that was against all medical knowledge. And so these are the kinds of stories where it gets really exciting. And you know, when people approach me and you know, my parents' fourth stage of cancer or so on, I mean, gee, it takes miracles. It doesn't matter which medicine, right? But just knowing that, you know, when we eat our mushrooms, we might already do something on the preventative side. And then, you know, maybe we run into peoples where we know, okay, try that mushroom or try this mushroom. And you're putting out maybe, you know, $150 for 3 months or maybe $100 for 3 months trying, does it make a difference or not? And if it does, what a gift, you know. And if it doesn't, well, you spend probably, what is it, a couple of days of costs of your prescription drugs on trying a natural substance. Right. So, you know, that's more the level where I'm there with the medicinal mushrooms. So I'm not there to prescribe anybody or tell them stop taking this and start taking this. But, you know, it's like, hey, look into that, try that. And it's so nice to know. I mean, like the oyster mushrooms containing lovastatin, you know, I mean, how many people put out money to get that daily, even if you don't know if, you know, in Europe, they don't prescribe these things like out here. They're much more conservative in prescribing these blood pressure medicines, but hey, oyster mushrooms do have it too. You know, don't need to eat them daily, and maybe if you eat them daily, we figure out a new issue. But they need their cooking. They pleurotolysin is one of the troublesome which attacks red blood cells, but it is absolutely sensitive to heating them up. So you cook them and it's right away, it's neutralized. But, you know, it tells us you should eat, you should cook your oysters. And I'm sure there's people out there who ate them raw because you get them in a store and you eat button mushrooms raw. But, hey, we haven't heard about anybody dying from them yet. So that's good. Yeah.
Well, I can see that impetus with fresh oyster mushrooms because they do look amazing. So I can see someone trying to eat it. But, yeah, I appreciated your grounded approach not to over-sensationalize it, which I think is why a lot of people who are foragers, mycophagists, mycologists hesitate to dive into the medicinal world because they say, hey, I don't want to oversell these. There's still a lot of research that needs to be done. But I felt you did that in a very good way in your book to work that in there. And yes, not prescribe and say, throw away all your medicine and just take mushrooms. You know, if anything, this is adjunctive, we're still exploring. And that is the thing, is people trying things and the anecdotes that come out of that do open up new possibilities. And I have to believe that the bioprospecting potential in some of these mushrooms, there are going to be companies that dive into the research. You know, so we'll just have to see if the US takes up that and keeps that research going.
It's happening. And I mean, there is so much more been done in East Asia and also in Europe, you know, because people just have such a more positive connection to mushrooms and a tradition also of using them in that way. So, yeah, I hope, you know, it's just something that should be on the radar, and it's great to know. And when it makes as much sense, like with the chanterelles, when you see we have no larvae in the chanterelles, you know, how they managed to fight them off. And then, you know, Robert Rogers, I found in his book, and he pointed it out to me how he encountered that in Lithuania, they used dried chanterelles or alcohol extract of chanterelles to fight intestinal parasites, you know. So it makes just so much sense when these things come together, right? And if you cook them, you're supposedly neutralizing the active ingredient. So you gotta powder them and dry it, or you gotta have an alcohol extract. But it would be really nice to have also the research done that looked into what compounds are these actually, and yeah.
And they may be too rare to work it into livestock feed, but I love that you said that because where I am in Sonoma County, California, there's agricultural colleges, a lot of ag research out here, and they're actually using different types of yeast right now. They got impressed by a certain type of yeast that they're able to feed goats and cows, and now people are taking it that's supposedly eliminating lowering the antibiotic load. So yeah, there's going to be, you know, we think about medicinal mushrooms for us, but yeah, for livestock, animals. Yeah,
so I've seen research that was, maybe 8-10 years ago, and where they were adding a little bit, I think, was it shiitake or maitake, something like that, to the cattle feed, and the herd health just went up, you know, and it was so much cheaper, and you don't have all these negative side effects of you know, wearing off our antibiotics. And I mean, such a big issue and so unnecessary.
That might be the biggest medicinal impact is changing how we do antibiotics and how we take care of livestock. So that's incredible. Well, obviously this is a book about foraging, about hunting mushrooms. Just to lay it out for people, I kind of see where we are in time, but you know, you talk about the hunt, you talk about preparing for the hunt. That is something I love about the book, is it makes me want to go out and mushroom hunt. You do a great job, obviously, describing the mushrooms. You mentioned chanterelle. I didn't cover chanterelle just because that is the big mushroom. That is the Pacific Northwest mushroom. There is tons in the book about chanterelles and boletes, but I do want to make sure we touch on the cooking side of it. I was kind of inspired by some of your recipes. So, you know, just tell us a little bit about where the recipes came from, what your goal was by including that, and if you have any kind of overarching tips, because you say, you know, this is just for inspiration. So are there any like Winkler guidelines in the kitchen working with mushrooms, anything like
that? Well, I think you got to know that how you prepare your mushrooms makes a big difference. And if you do it always the same way for all the mushrooms, you know, you don't do justice. And such a great example is using dry frying. When you fry your mushrooms without using butter or oil first, and that especially applies to any mushroom that has been out in the rain for too long, but also certain mushrooms, especially like the swillers, the jacks, slippery jacks and so on, which when you fry them in butter and oil, they turn into a disgusting mush. And you're never going to enjoy their taste because the presentation and the consistency is so off-putting. And so people really despise this abundant group of bolides, although they have a great bolide earthy taste. And the key is dry frying. Well, first, of course, you maybe since there's so many of them, you don't pick the ones that are already a little too old. You know, you stick with the young, firm stuff. And if it's a sticky, one of the slippery jacks, then you peel the cap that comes off in one piece. But when you start out dry frying, the mushroom will release its water and firm up. The tissue firms up and you really get out the taste, and it makes such a big difference. And here with our chanterelles too, I mean, I've been doing that for years and years. When we pick them in November or late October, when the rains come, this year was really, we went from drought into frost. So that's the worst scenario we can have, which is So dry frying makes such a difference to turn, or you have freshly washed a mushroom. You know, if you throw these wet mushrooms into oil, it's awful. So dry frying makes such a big difference for so many mushrooms, and certain groups of mushrooms, you really can, you can get so much quality, add so much quality to them once you know that little trick. So that's really, I think that's the most important point. And it's not a secret. Many people have that figured out. There's even articles out there online, the one chef that says now everybody else makes it wrong and he knows exactly how to do it. But when you dry fry your chanterelles that have been for 2 weeks in the refrigerator, you're just going to burn them because they already evaporated so much water. So, you know, it's the right moment. It's the right method. And in general, there's like two groups of maybe the recipe. So there's is like my comfort food, how I love my mushrooms. And yes, I admit to, I love them in a cream sauce. I learned from my mother and play around with that through the years. So a whole range of mushroom comfort food. And then I'm really fascinated also by using mushrooms that like what I learned from Chad Hyatt and his excellent wild mushroom cookbook. You know, this hummus made out of Russula brevipes, out of the short-stemmed brittle gill. And this is a mushroom, you know, we all ignored out there in the woods. And yes, it has had a good consistency, but unless it was infected by the lobster, you know, people would kick it, right? And upset that it wasn't a white chanterelle or matsutake. But you can make such a cool hummus out of it. Or then I turned witch's butter, saw a recipe online. I credit it to the person. The name is not just, it's just not coming to my mind. Sorry. She made a fruit leather out of witch's butter. So there is, you know, here in December, January, very much lowered fungal activity in the forests, even though not frozen. But then we have all these witch's butters there. And you know, you marinate them in an orange juice. You add a little bit of pear and maybe some spices. And then you make a fruit leather out of them. I just love that when you have something that basically it has no value as it is in the forest. Yes, right. A witch's butter is nice, you know, when you have a dry throat, you can eat a little bit and say, hey, it doesn't kill me. And yes, I get a little bit of a moisture out of it. But otherwise, you know, it's not, I mean, it's weird. That's the most exciting part. But then turning that into something. So that's the spectrum. And yes, I'm very much informed by European cuisine. You know, I heard the immigrants always stick the longest to their country's cuisine. You know, it's the one part they, I'm not going to let go of that one. but then also have from Davi, Cambodian born, great chef living here in the Seattle area. So I asked her for one of her recipes, chanterelle skewers in an awesome lemon leaf, cilantro, ginger, galanga sauce, you know, a little bit Asian cooking there too. And then of course, matsutake, you always end up having some Asian cooking there. But I think so many things like with the matsutake, one of the main informations is, you know, whatever you would cook with soy works great. Matsutake works great with, you know, in a cream sauce, no, it clashes. But, you know, miso soup, of course, traditionally you have them. But just to fry them and then deglaze them with a little bit of soy and then sake or white wine. And, you know, it's so great. And for years, we were told that frying matsutake would kill the aroma, but that's not the case. Michael Buke pointed that out. And then he contradicts everything I've heard so far. And right, he was. So ever since then, I'm happy to fry my matsutake and then, you know, deglaze them. That wasn't his suggestion. But so, you know, and often I just offer inspiration, say, hey, you have that recipe, and then you substitute this or that, and, you know, leave out the meat and put the mushroom in there. The crab cakes are awesome. You know, what used to be crab cakes, and I mean, everybody talks about it, and rightly so, but we can use the hericiums or corals, you know, a little bit more fibrous, longish mushrooms make great crab cakes, and so tasty and so much fun. So I did already a bunch this year, and definitely I was forced to diversify my cooking, and the poor family had to endure when I was taking pictures before we eat it. You know, it's like, you know, we're cold food. Well, you go ahead. I got to take this picture. And yeah, that was a challenge because I never quantify when I cook. I'm the worst person following, you know, direct instructions when cooking. Yeah. I look at it and yes, I do follow, but then I taste, oh, I like a little bit more garlic, a little bit more of that. And so then trying to quantify my own cooking was a bit of a challenge, but my daughter really helped me. She likes to write recipes, and that was very helpful, Sophia. Yeah. So, and then I also talk to publishers, say, hey guys, this is a field guide. We don't want to have a third of the book recipes. So it's now a little less than 50 pages out of 400 pages. So an eighth, which is little enough to still take in the forest, and definitely enough to give a lot of ideas.
It gives a ton of ideas. It's kind of rapid fire, all these different ideas and mushrooms being used. To call out one that I really want to try was the fire coral with blue potatoes. Not only because it sounds good, and I've never really eaten coral, but because it just looks so good.
Who tipped you off? You got me here at my weakest point. So it looks so awesome. We had these blue potatoes and then the fire coral. And yeah, I was so excited figuring out they're edible. I've seen them and took pictures. And so the corals have such great structure, and we know so little specifically which species are troublesome and which not. And it's never okay. with our corals. It's not about organ failure. So it's an intestinal upset. But, you know, I mean, throwing up is not a pleasant thing. I recently just had a stomach virus. I knew it wasn't a mushroom because I haven't eaten any. And it's just, you know, okay, yeah, this is really not something we want to bring on. Right. And so the corals, over 80 species here in the Pacific Northwest. And in spring, we know the handful of yellow corals we have are harmless and good edibles. People complain they're so hard to clean, but no, you just wash them. I mean, they're all day out in the rain anyways when it rains. They handle water very well. And then you can always start dry frying, but corals, often it's not even necessary because they are protected. They don't absorb the rain like crazy. So the red corals, the one I have in the book, I have to admit, is a little on the bitter side. It's not inedible bitter, but it was a little, should I put it in or not? But I saw other people who also enjoyed it, and I just couldn't, you know, it was just so beautiful. And it was a great meal, but it was, you know, I don't think it will take the culinary world in a storm. Unless you find a way how to... I mean, they sometimes are a little bitter, sometimes not. So it's not a reliable characteristic, but it would be interesting if there's a way to reduce it or not.
Yeah, maybe add a little lemon or something. Well, part of what we do is we eat with our eyes. So that one, definitely check that box. Where I was like, I want that.
I know. That's why it's in there. It just looks so beautiful with the blue.
It looks beautiful. And I would be remiss if I didn't ask for one. Of course, you're going to have so many, but maybe a recipe, if there is one, from family or from some of your heritage for the Steinpils, for the bolete. If there's a recipe in there in particular that, because, you know, and I don't want to call it out if this is the one, but like, I loved the bolete butter. I was like, oh my God, I want to do that. and make Bo Leap butter. But is there one in there that comes from maybe your heritage or, you know, has a particular story for the porcini?
Well, I do love them in a cream sauce. So that is definitely family heritage. Most of the time we would, my mom would do it in a cream sauce and, you know, deglaze with white wine. I like a bunch of onions in there and, you know, they add a nice little bit of sweetness and I usually fry them separate or put them in very late because the mushrooms need much more time and king bullets get so much better if they get time to caramelize. And yeah. Then what's the other one? The Maillard process.
Maillard right reaction. About that.
Yeah. So when each side gets time to be a little browned and gives also more structure. So, you know, and then I always have in my fridge, I have this bullet butter. So, you know, powdered bullets. And now my problem is that I have enough king bullets. So I haven't done as much experimenting with non king bullets, but, it doesn't have to be king bullets. So the thing is, when you make a butter or when you powder your mushrooms, you've got to make sure these mushrooms are non-toxic, uncooked. So is the drying enough? You know, when we do it at 120, 130 degrees, really dry them, there is a whole bunch of toxins that will already be eliminated. I mean, dried morels are much, much less problematic than non-morels that are cooked in the fresh state. So, you know, but we don't have the research. So I ask around and one of the people I always ask is Dennis Benjamin, who wrote years ago already, you know, Mushrooms, Panacea and Poison or Panacea. So he's now a retired medical doctor who is really into, you know, mushrooms and mushroom poisons and toxins. And the other one is, of course, always Michael Buke, who collects the information on poisonings in the U.S. for NAMA, the North American Mycological Association. So, you know, these are people where I double check, maybe not everything. And in the end, it's you know, I shouldn't delegate any responsibility, but they are great resources in what they have published. So when you dry mushrooms, like I would not use a dried shaggy parasol powder in a butter because there was no cooking process. The point would be probably maybe first, maybe parboiling for 5 minutes or something or 10 minutes. And then afterwards drying and grinding them up, which then, you know, it's like, that's a bit much of a process, right? So, their powder still can be used whenever you cook in a sauce. You know, they will do a great job. The stems of the parasols are often quite tough. And so they make great powders, but I'm not going to put them on my popcorn. You know, like a king bullet that's raw and ground up, I know it is harmless. And with the, maybe if I was more dedicated, I would make these experiments and see if I get sick. But on the other side, my system might be less sensitive than a whole bunch of other systems. And then, definitely. You know, I go out and say, hey, don't worry, this is all fine. And then, so it's just something we don't know enough about yet. And not knowing the toxins in there, of course, we can't test them for, are they gone? Is 140 degrees for 6 hours, are they neutralized? And that would be right. So cool to know. You know, there's still so much research needed.
Well, we can't leave it all at your feet and certainly can't expect you to run every experiment to test. I think your family is already probably a little overdone with experimenting with mushrooms at this point. Got to give them a break.
I'm never the first one, you know. It's like I, in this regard, I'm a wimp. I don't need to figure out if something. Well, right now I was wondering, we have hardly any mushrooms, but everywhere we have Strubilurus, the cone mushroom, and that comes very quickly after the rains are back on Douglas firs. Now in Europe, there's a Strubilurus that is double the size, and it's called Esculentus, the edible cone mushroom. So there's a tradition of eating that. So there's like, oh, maybe I look up the genetics. If they are really close together and this is a respected edible in Europe, can we make the leap to the Pacific Northwest one? So I have at least the mind games are there, but I haven't made such a leap yet. David well, Aurora is very good in doing these things, you know. And I would say, well, I have family, you know, but kids, so I better don't do that stuff.
Well, I appreciated that too so much in the book of how much credit you gave and sourcing things, giving people not only the opportunity to go look up, but also providing that invaluable aggregation function where you have such a knowledge and fluency in different people's work. You're able to bring that to your guide as well as your own knowledge. And I think it makes for an excellent collection, an excellent guide. So when is the book coming out? Where can people get the book? All of that good stuff. Get us excited. Tell people where to go get it.
It's officially in the stores, I think, tomorrow. It's already out. And I've been mailing it out since 3 weeks. And of course, I'm very happy if you order it from my mushroaming.com webpage. And usually I mail out within a day or two. Feel already guilty if it's 2 days. And that way I really benefit nicely. If it's out in Amazon or in a bookstore, I get a pathetic $1.20 at this point. And yes, it will go up to $1.40 when the first 5,000 have been sold or something. So it's really, I wasn't really aware of that reality while I was working in the book, and probably good so. But it seems, and part of it, I appreciate the Mountaineers because they have such a good distribution network in the Pacific Northwest. And I was seeing if they could help me with my edible fold out, because I tried to have it for years in REI, you know, backpacking. This is what the backpacker should take, is that fold out, that lightweight fold out.
Absolutely.
And what they were selling was not regional and books. And I just couldn't believe it. And I never could cut through the bureaucracy of buying books for REI. I tried, you know, anyway, so that's how I got in touch with them in the first place some years ago. So they have a really nice distribution network, and, you know, at REI they have it, and all the big bookstores will have it, and it's available wherever. And I'm very happy if you support your local bookstores. You know, you don't just have to think of me. Now the local bookstores need to survive as well. And I'll do a whole bunch of talks for small bookstores, because, you know, it's a dying breed, and that's really, really sad. We shooten ourselves by only shopping online. But hey, great to get it from the author. I will sign it, and especially if you ask. So far I signed them all, but yeah, let me know if you want that.
So in order from preference, go to Mushroaming and then support your local bookstores everywhere but Amazon. That is a joke, Amazon. Do not do anything to the book. Keep it high on your list. But yes, that's terrific. And I know bookshop.org is a good place too. If you still want to shop online, but you want to support bookstores, bookshop.org can be a good resource for that. And you talked about mushrooming. Any plans coming up? I know everyone's kind of getting out and everything's happening. But any plans? Obviously, this is a whole level of organization and logistics and everything to put these trips together, but anything in the future plans for mushrooming?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I'm way behind. Usually I already, you know, the fungal fellowship would have been already assembled for April in Colombia. I haven't put the final touches to the webpage, and that's hopefully going out within the next week or two that is out. And then also that will be late April, early May next year. And then in late August, Bhutan again. And half the crew will be the people who had already signed up, but then COVID hit. And if this is something that interests you, send me an email on mushroaming.com. It's a contact page. Let me know. And then I put you in a list. And, you know, I got to have some kind of a filter if there's more interest than I have places to offer. So, and that will be definitely something that informs me how long a person is trying to join a trip. So don't want to call it a wait list because I haven't given away any places yet, but something like that. So yeah, that's what's coming up in regard. I don't know what I'm tackling next. I didn't talk about that. I made with Gary Gilbert from Massachusetts. I made a bullet card set. So it's micro cards. And it's 54 tarot size cards. So where we have the bullets, it's called Western North America. So there's like the Colorado bullets are in there, lots of swillers that have wide distribution. But Pacific Northwest, California, also, you know, BC, Alaska. And so that's 54 species of bullets, which give you a nice overview. And great tool to get to know your bleeds. And that was another thing I produced. I forgot. That was when I was working on the bleeds for the book. Gary contacted me and said, oh, yeah, we can churn that out quickly. Of course, nothing goes so quickly. And we had new ideas how to improve it and add, you know, distribution area, common names, editability. That was things missing on the first editions on the Eastern bleeds Gary did. So, yeah, that's another thing I did and I really like. And it taught me so much about the bleeds, which is such a great group of mushrooms.
Well, if there's one place that I really want to expand my fungal portfolio, it is the boletes. Having gone and hunted different places, in Colorado, seeing all the huge scaber stalks and being a little wary of them. And out here, you know, you have the Zeller's bolete, you have color staining. I mean, the boletes are a fascinating family, I guess, of mushrooms to explore. So I love that idea.
And they're pretty safe with a little bit of knowledge. So don't eat anything with red pores. Yes, there is some that seem to work for most people, but in general, red pores, stay away. And then the bitter bolets will upset a lot of systems without being really toxic. And then, you know, then another problem is lexinum. You got to cook them very well. And some swillers, some people get a little bit of loose stool or something like that, apparently, especially when they don't remove the sticky cap tissue. Right. So, but then otherwise, you know, it's nice that it's such a benign group of mushrooms and yeah, they're still always like, oh, I don't know, what's that guy? But still it's, there's very little toxicity in there, you know, and some of them, you got to cook them well, but there's even some you can eat raw, like the king bolets. Most people makes an awesome salad, you know, if you just freshly cut them. And yeah, some people get upset stomach, but it's a small minority. It's nothing to worry about. And once you figure it out, you know, don't go there again and don't eat a lot when you do it for the first time.
Well, I think we owe you a debt of gratitude, not only in sharing these resources with the world, putting your knowledge together, but also for navigating distribution networks. And when you really get into how a book or a pamphlet gets out to people, it's like, wow, I really have that much more appreciation for authors who bothered writing it and then dealing with all of the moving parts. So huge amount of gratitude there. But thank you very much for all your effort. And I'll have us wrap up with the three questions that I like to ask all of my guests. And the first one is just a mushroom or fungus you love and why. And I always tell people this is not a favorite, an all-time favorite. I would never expect you to be able to choose that. But just a mushroom or fungus that you love and why.
So the last time I talked to you, I mentioned cordyceps and the king bolete, so I better don't repeat myself. And well, this year, let's pick the morel. I had really some disdain for the morel. It's like, I didn't get it. Why are people so obsessed with morels? And I had here in Kirkland, suburb from Seattle, I had some landscape morels, the laddered landscape morel, Morkella importuna in my yard. 3 out of 5 years, they were volunteering. And I just didn't get it. And then I cooked them on the side with werpers, with the thimble cap or spring morel. And it seemed the werper having had more taste than the landscape morel. So I was really down on them. And this spring, I walked the neighborhoods because it was so wet and cool for so long. And so we had a whole bunch of neighborhood morels, and then the fire morels kicked in, and it was just crazy. So really, and the fire morels, yes, there's four species at least out there. So I can't, you know, not, there's differences too, but it's still so hard to figure out what, but I really enjoyed my landscape morels this year too. So I don't know. I overcame that attitude. Part of it is also how to prepare them. Stuffing your morels is a really nice thing. And recipe, of course, is in the book. And then the fire morels were just amazing. And, you know, so it's interesting how personally there was years where I just was down on them and thought people are crazy with their morel obsession. And, yeah, I registered that people loved them and so on. But It has a great structure, you know, how easy you can try them, how you put them out in the sun and they get enriched with vitamin D. So very cool thing here in October, November, the sun is to dry your mushrooms is often not strong enough. And if the sun is strong enough, we don't have mushrooms apparently. But the structure is so nice of the morels and the taste. So there's a few things that really come together. And sadly, there's a few people who can't handle them. I don't meet too many of them, but and it seems to be when you read European research, like the ones growing with ash trees are more troublesome, or locusts. There's some locust associated ones too, and they are supposedly. So who knows? You know, there's still not enough research, but there seems to be indications that it could be their trees they team up with in whatever way they do it could also transfer some toxicity or toxins. But yeah, what a beautiful mushroom, and so cool now that we, through the DNA research, we have a much better handle on the species we have out here. Yeah. So Pacific Northwest, maybe 12, 13 species, and you know, half of them, okay, looking at them, you can have an idea what it is. And there's still enough out there that's like, oh, damn it, I would need DNA to be really sure. And we still will find some more, but I really enjoyed them this year.
Isn't that funny where you can think of someone who's had such an experience with foraging and working with different mushrooms, but then, you know, this morel, which so many people are obsessed with, and I had kind of a similar, or yeah, I had something similar where I hadn't tried morels just until a couple of years ago. So as much as you think you know about fungi and mushrooms, there's huge open avenues to explore and keep kind of opening yourself up to. And that gets at the heart of the next question, which is just what has this relationship you've developed with fungi given to you? It could be spiritual teachings, lessons you've learned, you know, whatever it is. But what has this relationship with fungi given to you?
Oh, it's given me so much. You know, it's... I mean, I love food, so there is a connection here. I love nature. I mean, I always loved nature, and you know, as a kid already was into plants, trying to learn their names and animals and so on, and feel just every hour spent in the forest felt great, and there wasn't like I need to do something else, and it's still the case, you know. Often, oh, I got to do this. I should be doing that. Why I'm not doing this? But when I'm in the forest, I'm in the forest or out in nature, and the mushrooms are such a nice connection to nature, you know, that they feed us, but that also the beauty out there and learning about their functions. And, you know, I love to listen to all your mushroom hours. That is so cool, learning about these people. And you think you know these people and you met these people when you listen to them for an hour and a half, you know, even if that field is not the first field of interest, you know. But It's given me a community of people, and it's such a nice, I don't know, filter is a little bit too negative a way, but you know, that shared interest, it's awesome. So I'm always worried that I'm not grateful enough to the mushrooms, you know, and taking mushroom pictures, of course, objectification, you know, how I objectify the poor mushrooms, and then my ageism that I want them as beautiful looking as possible, just in the right stage for photos. So there's still details to be worked out, but in general, I'm you know, I'm so happy to have that enrichment of my life through mushrooms and connecting to nature and to a place and to people through them. And yes, part of it is definitely that it's such a niche thing, you know, and how, especially here in the English-speaking world, how it's not mainstream yet. And, you know, it's not just like blackberries. Well, everybody picks blackberries, but the mushrooms is still has a whole different flair to it. You know, so, well, I don't know. I forgot the question, but
they're a locus by which so much coalesces around. And, you know, when you talk with people who are into mushrooms, if there's any sign someone is incredibly kind of tuned in and conscientious and trying to understand a non-human organism, it's when you start worrying about, am I being ageist? Am I objectifying by taking a photo? I think that's an indication that you've gone pretty deep in understanding these other organisms. And then the final question is just, if there are any books you're reading or other media, if you're not a reader, but any books you're reading right now that are impacting you, that you're enjoying, just some recommendations.
Well, I really enjoyed Entangled Life, which is not that new, but I was very upset that I thought I still had a quarter to go, and it was footnotes that were not in the text, you know. And I didn't see in the introduction that they're saying, hey, by the way, we have footnotes, but you don't realize that because you got to go to the back pages and then look up page 88, what has a footnote, which was a thing that was suggested for my book too. And I fought that. It's like, no, don't give me that experience. I have, reading wise, I don't have much on the horizon right now. I'm looking around. There's still a bunch of books. You know, I that project really drained me, and I had to take in so much. And, so I'm enjoying a little bit of a intellectual lull right now and maybe some other things. But, yeah, I mean, as I said, I love to listen to all these different mushroom hours and get such different impacts, insights, and, what a great idea to connect to people and, learn about aspects on that level that even if you meet these people, to get them to talk to you for an hour like that, you know, it's like so you're really onto something there, Darren, and I'm very glad you do that. And what a smart move, man. I should have thought about that.
Well, believe me, it is definitely not too late. You know, there are all these awesome mushroom podcasts popping up, and we're only going to cover the tiniest fraction. So, you know, get in there and make the podcast. Well, that is a huge compliment. And I totally understand, you know, whenever I ask someone that just wrote a book, what's coming next? What do you want to share with us? Like, man, I just shared a book. I just spent years of my life writing and sharing a book. Give me a space to breathe. So I'm
glad to hear that, because I was really surprised that I couldn't answer that and didn't have a...
Take some space to reset, reintegrate, you know, spend time with the family, get out in nature, all that kind of thing. But yes, thank you for coming on again, you know, giving another thoughtful, insightful interview, covering your work, being so generous with your time. You're always a joy to speak with because you bring a lot of knowledge, but also a lot of passion and fun. And it's always fun talking to you. So Daniel, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Darren, and all the people who help you. So awesome. Keep up the good work.